serious problem. When he came down to the office Friday morning, he was confronted with the usual program for the Sunday morning edition. The News was one of the few evening papers in Raymond to issue a Sunday edition, and it had always been remarkably successful financially. There was an average of one page of literary and religious items to 30 or 40 pages of sport, theater, gossip, fashion, society, and political material. This made a very interesting magazine of all sorts of reading matter, and had always been welcomed by all subscribers, church members and all, as a Sunday morning necessity. Edward Norman now faced this fact and put to himself the question, what would Jesus do? If he was editor of a paper, would he deliberately plan to put into the homes of all the church people and Christians of Raymond such a collection of reading matter on the one day in the week which ought to be given up to something better, holier? He was, of course, familiar with the regular arguments of the Sunday paper, that the public needed something of the sort, and the working man especially, who would not go to church anyway, ought to have something entertaining and instructive on Sunday, his only day of rest. But suppose the Sunday morning paper did not pay? Suppose there was no money in it? How eager would the editor or publisher be then to supply this crying need of the poor workman? Edward Norman communed honestly with himself over the subject. Taking everything into account, would Jesus probably edit a Sunday morning paper? No matter whether it paid? That was not the question. As a matter of fact, the Sunday News paid so well that it would be a direct loss of thousands of dollars to discontinue it. Besides, the regular subscribers had paid for a seven-day paper. Had he any right now to give them less than they supposed they had paid for? He was honestly perplexed by the question. So much was involved in the discontinuance of the Sunday edition that for the first time he almost decided to refuse to be guided by the standard of Jesus' probable action. He was sole proprietor of the paper. It was his to shape as he chose. He had no board of directors to consult as to policy, but as he sat there surrounded by the usual quantity of material for the Sunday edition, he reached some definite conclusions, and among them was a determination to call in the force of the paper and frankly state his motive and purpose. He sent word for Clark and the other men in the office, including the few reporters who were in the building and the foreman, with what men were in the composing room. It was early in the morning, and they were not all in, to come into the mailing room. This was a large room, and the men came in curiously and perched around on the tables and counters. It was a very unusual proceeding, but they all agreed that the paper was being run on new principles anyhow, and they all watched Mr. Norman carefully as he spoke. I called you in here to let you know my further plans for the News. I propose certain changes which I believe are necessary. I understand very well that some things I have already done are regarded by the men as very strange. I wish to state my motive in doing what I have done. Here he told the men what he had already told Clark, and they stared as Clark had done, and looked as painfully conscious. Now, in acting on this standard of conduct, I have reached a conclusion which will, no doubt, cause some surprise. I have decided that the Sunday morning edition of the News shall be discontinued after next Sunday's issue. I shall state in that issue my reasons for discontinuing. In order to make up to the subscribers the amount of reading matter they may suppose themselves entitled to, we can issue a double number on Saturday, as is done by many evening papers that make no attempt at a Sunday edition. I am convinced that from a Christian point of view, more harm than good has been done by our Sunday morning paper. I do not believe that Jesus would be responsible for it if he were in my place today. It will occasion some trouble to arrange the details caused by this change with the advertisers and subscribers. That is for me to look after. The change itself is one that will take place. So far as I can see, the loss will fall on myself. Neither the reporters nor the pressmen need make any particular changes in their plans. He looked around the room and no one spoke. He was struck for the first time in his life with the fact that in all the years of his newspaper life, he had never had the force of the paper together in this way. Would Jesus do that? That is, would he probably run a newspaper on some loving family plan where editors, reporters, pressmen, and all meet to discuss and devise and plan for the making of a paper that should have in view? He caught himself drawing almost away from the facts of typographical unions and office rules and reporters' enterprise and all the cold, businesslike methods that make a great daily successful. But still the vague picture that came up in the mailing room would not fade away when he had gone into his office and the men had gone back to their places with wonder in their looks and questions of all sorts on their tongues as they talked over the editor's remarkable actions. Clark came in and had a long, serious talk with his chief. He was thoroughly roused, and his protest almost reached the point of resigning his place. Norman guarded himself carefully. Every minute of the interview was painful to him, but he felt more than ever the necessity of doing the Christ-like thing. Clark was a very valuable man. It would be difficult to fill his place. But he was not able to give any reasons for continuing the Sunday paper that answered the question, "What would Jesus do?" by letting Jesus print that edition. "It comes to this, then," said Clark frankly. "You will bankrupt the paper in 30 days. We might as well face that future fact."
"I don't think we shall."
"Will you stay by the News until it is bankrupt?" asked Norman with a strange smile.
"Mr. Norman, I don't understand you. You are not the same man this week that I always knew before."
"I don't know myself either, Clark. Something remarkable has caught me up and borne me on, but I was never more convinced of final success and power for the paper. You have not answered my question. Will you stay with me?"
Chapter 5
Sunday morning dawned again on Raymond, and Henry Maxwell's church was again crowded. Before the service began, Edward Norman attracted great attention. He sat quietly in his usual place about 3 seats from the pulpit. The Sunday morning issue of the News, containing the statement of its discontinuance, had been expressed in such remarkable language that every reader was struck by it. No such series of distinct sensations had ever disturbed the unusual business custom of Raymond. The events connected with the News were not all. People were eagerly talking about strange things done during the week by Alexander Powers at the railroad shops and Milton Wright in his stores on the Avenue. The service progressed upon a distinct wave of excitement in the pews. Henry Maxwell faced it all with a calmness which indicated a strength and purpose more than usual. His prayers were very helpful. His sermon was not so easy to describe. How would a minister be apt to preach to his people if he came before them after an entire week of eager asking, "How would Jesus preach? What would he probably say?" It is very certain that he did not preach as he had done 2 Sundays before. Tuesday of the past week he had stood by the grave of the dead stranger and said the words, "Earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust." And still he was moved by the spirit of a deeper impulse than he could measure, as he thought of his people and yearned for the Christ message when he should be in his pulpit again. Now that Sunday had come and the people were there to hear, what would the Master tell them? He agonized over his preparation for them, and yet he knew he had not been able to fit his message into his ideal of the Christ. Nevertheless, no one in the first church could remember ever hearing such a sermon before. There was in it rebuke for sin, especially hypocrisy. There was definite rebuke of the greed of wealth and the selfishness of fashion. Two things that First Church never heard rebuked this way before. And there was a love of his people that gathered new force as the sermon went on. When it was finished, there were those who were saying in their hearts, "The Spirit moved that sermon," and they were right. Then Rachel Winslow rose to sing, this time after the sermon, by Mr. Maxwell's request. Rachel's singing did not provoke applause this time. What deeper feeling carried the people's heart into a reverent silence and a tenderness of thought?
Rachel was beautiful, but her consciousness of her remarkable loveliness had always marred her singing with those who had the deepest spiritual feeling. It had also marred her rendering of certain kinds of music with herself. Today this was all gone. There was no lack of power in her grand voice, but there was an actual added element of humility and purity which the audience distinctly felt and bowed to. Before service closed, Mr. Maxwell asked those who had remained the week before to stay again for a few moments of consultation, and any others who were willing to make the pledge taken at that time. When he was at liberty, he went into the lecture room. To his astonishment, it was almost filled. This time, a large proportion of young people had come, but among them were a few businessmen and officers of the church. As before, he, Maxwell, asked them to pray with him. And as before, a distinct answer came from the presence of the Divine Spirit. There was no doubt in the minds of any present that what they proposed to do was so clearly in line with the divine will that a blessing rested upon it in a very special manner. They remained some time to ask questions and consult together. There was a feeling of fellowship such as they had never known in their church membership. Mr. Norman's actions was well understood by them all, and he answered several questions. "What will be the probable result of your discontinuance of the Sunday paper?" asked Alexander Powers, who sat next to him. "I don't know yet. I presume it will result in the falling off of subscriptions and advertisements. I anticipate that." "Do you have any doubts about your action? I mean, do you regret it, or fear it is not what Jesus would do?" asked Mr. Maxwell. "Not in the least. But I would like to ask for my own satisfaction, if any of you here think Jesus would issue a Sunday morning paper." No one spoke for a minute. Then Jasper Chase said, "We seem to think alike on that, but I have been puzzled several times during the week to know just what he would do. It is not always an easy question to answer." "I find that trouble," said Virginia Page. She sat by Rachel Winslow. Everyone who knew Virginia Page was wondering how she would succeed in keeping her promise. "I think perhaps I find it especially difficult to answer that question on account of my money. Our Lord never owned any property, and there is nothing in His example to guide me in the use of mine. I am studying and praying. I think I see clearly a part of what He would do, but not all. What would He do with $1 million? Is my question, really. I confess I am not yet able to answer it to my satisfaction." "I could tell you what you could do with part of it," said Rachel, turning her face toward Virginia. "That does not trouble me," replied Virginia, with a slight smile. "What I am trying to discover is a principle that will enable me to come to the nearest possible to His action, as it ought to influence the entire course of my life, so far as my wealth and its use are concerned." "That will take time," said the minister slowly. All the rest of the room were thinking hard of the same thing. Milton Wright told something of his experience. He was gradually working out a plan for his business relations with his employees, and it was opening up a new world to him and to them. A few of the young men told of special attempts to answer the question. There was almost general consent over the fact that the application of the Christ spirit and practice to the everyday life was a serious thing. It required a knowledge of him and an insight into his motives that most of them did not yet possess. When they finally adjourned after a silent prayer that marked with growing power the divine presence, they went away discussing earnestly their difficulties and seeking light from one another. Rachel Winslow and Virginia Page went out together. Edward Norman and Milton Wright became so interested in their mutual conference that they walked on past Norman's house and came back together. Jasper Chase and the president of the Endeavor Society stood talking earnestly in one corner of the room. Alexander Powers and Henry Maxwell remained, even after the others had gone. "I want you to come down to the shops tomorrow and see my plan and talk to the men. Somehow I feel as if you could get nearer to them than anyone else just now."
I don't know about that, but I will come, replied Mr. Maxwell a little sadly. How was he fitted to stand before 200 or 300 working men and give them a message? Yet, in the moment of his weakness, as he asked the question, he rebuked himself for it. What would Jesus do? That was an end to the discussion. He went down the next day and found Mr. Powers in his office. It lacked a few minutes of 12, and the superintendent said, "Come upstairs, and I'll show you what I've been trying to do." They went through the machine shop, climbed a long flight of stairs, and entered a very large, empty room. It had once been used by the company for a storeroom. "Since making that promise a week ago, I have had a good many things to think of," said the superintendent, "and among them is this. The company gives me the use of this room, and I am going to fit it up with tables and a coffee plant in the corner there where those steam pipes are. My plan is to provide a good place where the men can come up and eat their noon lunch and give them 2 or 3 times a week the privilege of a 15-minute talk on some subject that will be a real help to them in their lives." Maxwell looked surprised and asked if the men would come for any such purpose. "Yes, they'll come. After all, I know the men pretty well. They are among the most intelligent working men in the country today. But they are, as a whole, entirely removed from church influence." I asked, "What would Jesus do?" And among other things, it seemed to me he would begin to act in some way to add to the lives of these men more physical and spiritual comfort. It is a very little thing, this room and what it represents, but I acted on the first impulse to do the first thing that appealed to my good sense, and I want to work out this idea. I want you to speak to the men when they come up at noon. I have asked them to come up and see the place, and I'll tell them something about it." Maxwell was ashamed to say how uneasy he felt at being asked to speak a few words to a company of working men. How could he speak without notes, or to such a crowd? He was honestly in a condition of genuine fright over the prospect. He actually felt afraid of facing those men. He shrank from the ordeal of confronting such a crowd, so different from the Sunday audiences he was familiar with. There were a dozen rude benches and tables in the room, and when the noon whistle sounded, the men poured upstairs from their machine shops below, and seating themselves at the table, began to eat their lunch. There were present about 300 of them. They had read the superintendent's notice, which he had posted up in various places, and came largely out of curiosity. They were favorably impressed. The room was large and airy, free from smoke and dust, and well warmed from the steam pipes. At about 1:20, Mr. Powers told the men what he had in mind. He spoke very simply, like one who understands thoroughly the character of his audience, and then introduced the Reverend Henry Maxwell of the First Church, his pastor, who had consented to speak a few minutes. Maxwell will never forget the feeling with which, for the first time, he stood before the grimy-faced audience of working men. Like hundreds of other ministers, he had never spoken to any gatherings except those made up of people of his own class, in the sense that they were familiar in their dress and education and habits. This was a new world to him, and nothing but his new rule of conduct could have made possible his message and its effect. He spoke on the subject of satisfaction with life, what caused it, what its real sources were. He had the great good sense on this, his first appearance, not to recognize the men as a class distinct from himself. He did not use the term working man and did not say a word to suggest any difference between their lives and his own. The men were pleased. A good many of them shook hands with him before going down to their work, and the minister, telling it all to his wife when he reached home, said that never in all his life had he known the delight he had then felt in having the handshake from a man of physical labor. The day marked an important one in his Christian experience, more important than he knew. It was the beginning of a fellowship between him and the working world. It was the first plank laid down to help bridge the chasm between the church and labor in Raymond. Alexander Powers went back to his desk that afternoon, much pleased with his plan and seeing much help in it for the men. He knew where he could get some good tables from an abandoned eating house at one of the stations down the road,
and he saw how the coffee arrangement could be made.